A quick note for our listeners. This Radio Parkies presentation is sponsored by YOPN Network and includes people who have been living with Parkinson's for quite some time. The vocal challenges that you hear are due to the progression of this disease as well as deep brain stimulation surgeries. And we come as we are here. Everyone has a purpose and a contribution, and everyone is welcome. Thank you for listening.
You are unique, active, determined, resilient. You are not your diagnosis, and you are not alone. This is Young Onset Parkinson's Network. We believe young onset Parkinson's disease does not define you. You define it. We are a safe place to learn, connect, and engage within a supportive community that actually gets it, because we've got it too. Welcome to Young Onset Parkinson's Network. Living well starts here.
We'll be back with a full interview in 30 seconds.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity.
I might look similar to all of you, but I'm different, just slightly different. One mutation, actually. I was born with Gaucher's disease, a rare genetic illness that kept me going in and out of the hospital when I was a kid. And I can tell you that Gaucher's had its downside. There was the pain, the operations, and lots of needles. And if you had asked me at 14, I would have told you that my life was a total disaster. But that missing enzyme, it led me down an artistic path that I wouldn't have found otherwise, and it's a path that not only helped me, it helped and educated a lot of other people.
Today we're talking to Ted Meyer. Ted is a nationally recognized artist, curator, and patient advocate who helps patients, students, and medical professionals see the positive and the absolute worst that life could offer. Ted's decade-long project, Scarred for Life, Monoprints of the Human Scars, chronicles the trauma and courage of people who've lived through accidents and health crises. Wow. You have mentioned that you're uniquely qualified for this particular project. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I spent a lot of my childhood, I have a genetic illness, so I spent a lot of my childhood in the hospital. And if you're in the hospital a lot as a kid, you get used to talking to people, you get used to hearing their stories and what they've been through and commiserating and sharing. When I talk to people about their scars, it's very comfortable for me to talk to people about what they've been through. And so it just seemed like a normal thing.
Have you ever dealt with anybody with Parkinson's before?
Well, my brother had Parkinson's and landed up dying from Parkinson's. But there's no particular scars for Parkinson's, so Parkinsonian patients are not part of my scar project.
Yeah.
As well as the head.
Well, all three of us can do that.
Well, okay.
Heather was displaying her DBS scar.
Yeah. With exception of DBS, though, you are correct, generally. Yeah. We often have,
but I would be glad to print any of you. So for that,
yeah. We're good. I only hear that we have to just get naked and roll around in pain. Is that true?
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with the project. That's just for fun.
And Ted, I've also understood that with your disease that you had as a child, it's in remission. Is that correct?
No, it comes and goes, but there is a treatment. There's enzyme replacement. So basically, I'm stable at the moment. I've had several joints replaced, organs removed, but at the moment I'm stable. So I'm very lucky because this all came about at a point where I was not dead yet. I mean, I gave bone marrow when I was about 5 years old at NIH, and the treatment came when I was 42 years old. So that's how long the research was on this. So I was very lucky I made it to that point, and now I'm relatively healthy on a day-to-day basis, you know.
And there are some Parkinson's symptoms that you too have experienced?
Not me, but my brother. So if you have Gaucher's disease, there is some connections between Parkinsonian symptoms and Gaucher's. And there's a number of studies being done at NIH right now about the link between Gaucher's disease and Parkinson's. So there's Ellen Sadransky at NIH is doing research. And my brother and I were actually both part of a study for years about why he developed the Parkinson's and I didn't, because they're trying to see if there's a correlation if one sibling gets it and the others, if you have Gaucher's disease. So far, they have not found a link for that.
How old were you when you were diagnosed with Gaucher's disease?
I think I was 5 or 6 years old. Just, I had really, really severe bone pain. And I went to several hospitals. I was finally diagnosed at Mount Sinai in New York. Gaucher's is an illness that is predominantly in the Ashkenazi Jewish community, although it is a worldwide illness. It's a very old mutation genetically, but because Jews were ghettoized and in the olden days would marry cousins and things because nobody else wanted us, it sort of got embedded in the Ashkenazi community.
Is there any type of test for this?
Yes.
And what is that? I mean, what would people look up if they had something?
Well, there's a whole panel of genetic illness for lysosomal storage diseases. Usually, most anybody who is Jewish should get this entire panel of tests, because there's a number of diseases that Jews get for those same reasons of ghettoization. So there's like, I think there's 16 different illnesses, from Tay-Sachs to Gaucher's, Pompe disease. They're all illnesses that are predominant in the Jewish community.
Because I know when you get married, I think we tested for Tay-Sachs.
Yeah, but Tay-Sachs now is almost gone, because the Hasidic community, where it was very prevalent, they do arranged marriages. So everybody would get tested. And if two people who had it, who would have produced a child with it, their arranged marriage got redone and they landed up with somebody who didn't have it. So that it's sort of been bred out, actually.
That's good news.
Yeah.
At least one thing.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that's very much like the LRRK2 gene mutation. As I understand it, that's more prevalent in the Ashkenazi population. I happen to have LRRK2, so I was just thinking of that as another correlation.
We are chosen. We are the chosen
one. So, Ted, growing up as a child with Gaucher's disease, how did you deal with it? Just kind of day by day, just go on with it?
Well, I missed a lot of school. Luckily, I think. I never had to go to gym class. That was an upside. You know, you just deal with it. When you're a kid, you just deal with it, and you don't really know much different. So I was in the hospital, or I was home, or I missed school. That's just sort of the way it was. I've always been a big believer, if you have kids and you don't treat them really like they're sick, they won't really think they're that sick. That's their reality. I've worked with kids in hospitals that are like I was. I used to do all artwork in the hospital and draw. I was very content in there because I got a lot of attention and I got to draw all the time.
At what age did you find the enzyme?
I got it when I was 42.
How'd that feel? You must have been elated and feeling great all of a sudden.
Well, the main thing was I didn't have the severe pain later on, but fatigue. Fatigue was a really bad part of this illness. I could feel like I could lie down, fall asleep anywhere at any time. And the enzyme replacement took away a lot of that fatigue. And that in turn made it possible to start excelling at other things because I wasn't exhausted all the time.
I was just gonna say, we have no idea what you're talking about.
No.
Yeah.
I know, you guys, none of this stuff relates to you or anybody else in the world. It's all about me.
No.
But just being able to get to the place where you are at 42 is a big deal.
Yeah.
Love to know how that feels.
I mean, just to be able to wake up in the morning and not feel like you need to go right to bed was a huge thing. And especially when it came, I'm sure it's the same for you guys. I mean, being able to focus. I just for years found it very difficult to focus. I mean, I've always had a short attention span because I never went to school when I was a kid. I always had home teachers. But the idea of being able to focus on a project because my brain was working better, but also just because I wasn't so tired, I needed to stop after a half hour, made it a lot easier to be creative or just see a project all the way through.
Speaking of creativity, you mentioned the art cart lady with Mrs. Krasinski, Krasinski.
Yeah, so this was a woman who, when I was in the hospital as a kid, she came in one day and I was really pissed off. I had been in the hospital at that point. You know, on average, it was 3 to 4 times a year for a few weeks. But this time, I think I had been in for a much longer time. And I was really pissed off. And also, as I remember, I was not in a private room. So there were just like a whole bunch of really sick kids in the room with me who were, it was not a pleasant time. And she said to me, like, you can, if you don't like it here, you can draw about the fact you don't like it here. Like, I always thought I had to kind of keep it internal. And she started me on this path of doing artwork about what I was feeling about my medical condition. And she also said, you know, use a bandage in it, use an IV tube. And we started using things from around the hospital. And that's not that unusual now, but 50 years ago, it was really unusual. And this wasn't an art therapist. This was a volunteer at the hospital who was just good at working with kids. And I kind of owe her the entire arc of my creative life and career working with med students and meeting you guys, doing the talks and interviews with patients. It all sort of stems from that one woman just saying, oh, it's okay to tell everybody this is frustrating to you.
Do you think, does she know about the project or have you had contact with her?
I've tried to reach out to her. I mean, I'm 65 now, so yes. She was old. She had died a long time ago, but I did send a note through some friends in high school to her daughter, because her daughter was 2 years younger than me at the high school. So I was like, when you see her, let her know. So I know she knows that her mom made a big difference.
So you went from dark paintings to suddenly you went to nice light, cheery paintings.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure all you guys can relate to this, but when you're sick, and I always talk about this with med students or art students, you guys all know, so I'm speaking to the choir here, but it takes so much energy to be sick. And so it makes sense that was what would land up in my paintings, because I was always thinking about the fact that I was sick. Either I was in pain or I was exhausted, or I just couldn't figure out a future, how to make a plan. So that stuff all showed up in the paintings. And then once I landed up on the enzyme replacement, my color palette changed, the subjects changed. it was almost immediate. Once I wasn't thinking about my internal body all the time, I could stop thinking about putting myself on a canvas. And then I started doing work about other people. That's when I started the Scar Project, to tell other people's stories. But in my paintings, they became more colorful. They started having images that weren't about me, and they were about other people or desert or animals or whatever else. But it wasn't about me anymore, which was great because I was really sick of me by that point.
I find, as a witness to your work, that you close the gap on duality, that the subject and the author or the artist sort of blend to do this work together, this scar work, because it's so deeply personal. You've mentioned that when you're sick, it's very easy to be self-focused. And I notice you're using the language of like focusing on other people, which is really, talk about an act of service and catharsis. But I'd like for you to talk just a little bit about that hyper-focus we have when we experience intense or chronic pain, and how you've, you know, worked with that.
Well,
in your work.
But I used to just, I did series about my bodies, and I did a lot of skeletal images. I did a lot of very frantic people. And my marking system, when I would do those, the drawings were very pointy, and they were sharp, and they were stuck in boxes because I couldn't see a way out for myself in my life at that point. And so there were times when I would just take a pencil and scrape it into the paper, because I usually do sketches first, and I would scrape into the painting so hard, I would go through several sheets of paper and put a hole in them because I was so frustrated by what was going on with me. But it's like none of that happens now. It doesn't happen. I mean, the one thing now, and I'm sure you guys all feel this as, you know, your symptoms progress, is that clock ticking, like how much longer am I going to be able to do things? How much, you know, how much time do I have to live the life I want to live? And I feel pretty good now, but I know some of these symptoms are going to, over time, they're going to come back. I saw what happened with my brother. It could always happen with me. So I feel that clock ticking, just like you guys all do.
Well, kind of a related topic. You know, for me, acceptance of Parkinson's was a big part of being able to live well with Parkinson's. And one of the primary ways most of us find acceptance is through a community. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you really didn't have a community of other people your age or around you that you could talk to about your situation. If that's true, then do you think that the art cart lady, for lack of a better name, she helped you find that acceptance?
I think she did. You know, what was so interesting, when I was growing up, I only knew, when I was first diagnosed, they only knew of about 250 people with this illness. Now there's about 6,000 people worldwide on treatment. And now, if I was born now, I would get this medicine when I was a little kid, and I would never have symptoms. So that's the difference in, mm-hmm. in how this is treated. But yeah, I only knew one other person, and she died at about 19 or 20. So that was sort of always in my head, like, that's my future. My time is very limited. But when I moved to Los Angeles, there was a very strong Gaucher community here. And the drug companies, and some of us share drug companies because Sanofi makes a drug for you, they also make a drug for me. They spent tremendous amount of money for a long period of time holding these dinners. And like, we would go to Spago and we would go places like this, and we would have these patient meetings, because the drug, which costs $250,000 a year, it's so expensive, they wanted to make sure we wouldn't jump ship and go to another company that was making a drug for $250,000 a year. So all these companies were like fighting over us to keep us there. And they would have these amazing dinners, and we would all go to these dinners, to these restaurants none of us could afford. But we would all talk about what was going on with us. And for me, it was very interesting because my illness, it's again, a lot like you guys, because depending on where you are and everybody has different symptoms, ours has different symptoms. So some people, like my brother, develop Parkinson's. I have friends with it now who are having neurological problems where they're having trouble moving limbs, but it's not part of Parkinson's. It's just part of the Gaucher's. So we would have these talks, and as we're getting older, none of us expected to live this long. We're all having that conversation. Are my symptoms because I'm getting old, or are they because I have Gaucher's? You know, we don't know, because none of us expected to be here. We don't know what we're experiencing. Sort of interesting.
Yeah, that's great that you were able to find some community. Maybe it was all through the medical, the pharmaceutical companies, but at least you found that community to kind of share experiences with.
Yeah, and now there's a new group just for patients. I'm sure they get some funding from the different drug companies, but I don't know how much. But it's one of the patients has started a new group, and it's helpful. We can all communicate through that. They had their first convention this year, and it was very patient-centered rather than drug and research-centered.
So, Ted, you went from painting up people's scars to painting your own scars to start painting other people's scars. When and why did you make that change?
Well, I didn't actually, it was a little incorrect there. I never painted my own scars. I just did paintings about my situation. But what happened is when the pain went away, and when the fatigue went away, I didn't really know what to paint anymore, because I had been painting about all of that for so long. And I thought, well, maybe I'll start doing work about other people. And this is the other person in my life who made a big impact on me. There was a woman who was in a wheelchair, came up to me at an art gallery, and we started having a conversation. And I told her that I used to do work about myself, and now I was doing paintings of, you know, cats or something. And she said, well, you need to keep doing work about yourself. She was very emphatic that just because I was now healthier, it was still part of me. And I went home and I thought, oh, she's right. And I thought, well, maybe I can print her scar. She had had an accident, she'd broken her back. And I thought, maybe I should start documenting what other people have gone through. So basically, all this whole project started because I had run out of things to say about myself. And I will also say this woman was very compelling, and she was doing work about dance. Even though she was in a wheelchair, she was working with a dance company, she was acting, she was out there, she was an advocate, and she sort of convinced me that I still had something to say, even though at the time I wasn't sure I did.
And so you went from, she did a picture of her painting of her scar.
I did a print of her scar.
That's your print. I'm sorry for the lack of Parkinson's messed with the brain too.
That's all right.
All right. Went from a print of her scar to other people's scars, and all of a sudden you had your own show, your own art show going on.
Yeah.
Did you talk about how you got there and why and how it happened?
Yeah, so it's really interesting, because as an artist, you really want to connect with people, and different artists do it differently. You know, some want to paint a landscape and have people go, oh, that's a beautiful landscape. But I've always wanted to connect on a more personal level. So what happened is the first print I did, her name was Joy. I showed her print at the opening, and I showed two other people's prints at this art opening. And people saw them, and they started coming up, and they would open up their shirt, and they would pull down their pants, and they started telling me I have the scar. I went through this procedure and I survived this procedure. And will you do a print of my scar? And so it became this sort of amazing thing where I learned over the years, I've done 100 or so of these now, what everybody's scar means to them. And sometimes they look at them and it's a reminder of another person, or it's the accident that happened, but mostly it's survival. Most people come out of these accidents or operations feeling empowered. They have survived something, they've made it through the rehab. And for most people, it's a sign of strength. So I started telling these stories. And it's not like people disassociate the pain and the misery of a car accident or anything like that. Yeah, it was just amazing how many people felt like the scar was a living thing that was still a story for them. So I print the scars. If people call me, I get a lot of calls. I'm in from Europe, I'm going to be in LA, you know, can you print your scar for me, or print my scar for me? And I think for a lot of people, printing the scar gives them a finality to it. Like, they can look at it, they can put it on their wall and say, I went through that. That's what happened to me. And I think emotionally, it's sort of closure for a lot of people. Because, and again, you guys know, when you get an operation, everybody remembers the day of the operation, but there's no actual healing date because it's a long process. And sometimes your skin and bones have healed before your body total has healed, or you have healed emotionally. So I can give people a finish date. I can print their scar. They can put it on the wall and go, I'm done with it. That's what I went through. There it is. So I'll just keep doing these for the rest of my life. As long as people want me to do them, I'll do them.
You also have a story with this scar.
Yeah, everybody has to write a first person narrative of what the scar, how they got it, and what it means to them. And the only thing guidance I give them is say, when you walk out of the shower and you see it in the mirror, what do you think? That's the only thing I tell people. And it's, you know, again, I hear lots of amazing stories. And it's also interesting the difference in the way people relate to them. Like, I've done a lot of military people. And for them, the scar often represents not what happened to them, but what happened to their whole platoon or the person sitting next to them in a Humvee that got killed, but they survived. I just heard a story the other day of somebody who has a big scar along their neck. She was telling me that the person next to her got killed, and his body basically protected her from the shrapnel that killed him. So when she looks at the scar, she thinks about him, not herself. So whereas civilians, it tends to be a first person, I had an operation, I was in a car accident. So it's different, you know, they all have different meanings to different people.
What you're saying is so, I don't know if this is the right word, but comparable to what it is with the Parkinson's, except a lot of times our scars, so to speak, might be on the inside and from a mental wellness perspective. And what I'm hearing from you is that I've created a new campaign called No Limits, and that can be my Parkinson's. We have a Parkinson's pickleball team. It's No Limits. It's doing things that people would think we can't do. So I'm just wondering, how can we relate what you're doing to people with Parkinson's who are suffering maybe more on the inside? And I always think, where does my PD live? So 6 years ago, my PD lived inside of me, and then I moved it over a little bit. But I'm just curious, how do you think we could sort of formulate this into a plan for people with Parkinson's?
I don't want to pretend that I can even understand what you guys are going through. I mean, that's why the scars are really good for me, because there's a concrete thing I can print and hear a story.
Right.
And like, I have, watching my brother over the years, as he got less and less able to function, I don't even want to pretend like I can imagine what you guys are going through. I really don't. I have no suggestions, because I just can't even imagine it.
I mean, I think that basically from what you're saying, from what I hear, is that we socialize, we box, we play pickleball, we do all these different things. But I think it would be very helpful if people stepped out of their comfort zone and maybe started drawing. You know, I write, you draw. Maybe it's another way for Parkinson's people to get out what it is that we're talking about.
Yes, well, Miss Kennedy here is a great writer, and there's all different ways. It could just be sitting around in a circle and all talking about what you're going through. You know, I did some work at the University of Indiana the other day, and we did a bunch of scar prints of people in Indiana. And then we all sat around in a circle afterward to talk about what the scars meant to us. And it was amazing to hear everybody just sort of, the walls were down, and they discussed what the scars meant to them, and their memories during their medical procedures, and how it affected their families and children. So I'm a big believer in just talking things out. But I'm not a big believer in whining about it, you know, because of your situation. But and it was funny, because the first couple times I went to one of these Gaucher meetings, it was before many people were on medication. So there were still a lot of very sick people. And I found that a lot of the time, the parents who were there with kids, it was like this competition, whose kid was sicker, whose kid had suffered more. And I didn't want to hear that. I just, because we all have our own level of how much pain can we tolerate and how much exhaustion we can tolerate. And I just didn't really want to hear these parents going, well, my kid's sicker, my kid's been through more, you know.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't.
Horrible.
It doesn't. We're all there to support each other.
And what does that say to the kid? That just says, you know, I can't live within my own illness. They have to put some kind of, I don't know what the word is, but they're making the kid feel as if, oh, well, if I'm worse, then I'm better. But that's not right.
Yeah. Well, I don't see much of that anymore. But it was really interesting. This one meeting, I just remember like, shut up.
Have you ever heard of Chloe Cooper Jones?
I haven't.
She's someone, she's a disabled person. That's her words. And she talks about incredible physical pain and how she feels that she's judged and almost infantilized sometimes by others. Like the projection is put upon her. She has a visible disability. And I was listening to something called How to Be a Better Human.
Mm-hmm.
They were interviewing her, and she was, it's a podcast, because I want to be a better human. But the thing that I thought was neat was that she talks about, you get to a certain point where you stop allowing other people's projections to affect you. Because the second that you note that you are disabled in some way, whether it's visible or invisible, people treat you differently. Do you find that that's true?
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny. I find that a couple, yeah, I'll just say yeah. But at the same time, you know, it's funny, if I go back to New York where I grew up, the people who knew me, they knew me when I was a kid. I was always on crutches. I was really sick. And the people who know me now, they know that something's up with me, but they see the healthier version of me. So they all know that I do this work with medical education and patient advocacy. And they know it comes from somewhere, but they're not exactly sure what the basis of it is. So I'm sort of this mystery to them.
Do they ask? Do people ask you?
Not so much. I mean, if they hear interviews that I do, they kind of have an idea, but people don't really want to know that, I think. And again, it's probably something you guys know. When I was a kid, I learned really early, you can only be so sick and it turns other people off. Mm-hmm. You know, people, they'll go, oh, you got Parkinson's, how are you doing? And if you go, I had a good day, they're like, great. And if you say to them, I had a really bad day, I couldn't get up, and blah, 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 they'll be like, okay, yeah, well, then they're not going to ask again. So, you know, we all have to moderate our external image so we don't make all the healthy people, everyone's going to get something uncomfortable.
Right. And the toxic positivity police will show up sooner or later.
Yeah.
Do you feel like I'm 6 years in, I was 52 and I got diagnosed with Parkinson's. I'm still in that, I got to explain things and I don't want to be that person anymore. So talk a little bit about how you were able to not explain away the illness.
I just told people, it's funny. So my brother never talked about his illness. And as he got sicker, nobody knew what was going on with him. Whereas I just, even as a kid, even though there's lots of things going on with my body, I had a lot of bone problems. So I was on crutches a lot. And I would just say to people, it's like arthritis, but it's worse. And that was enough of an explanation for people. So I didn't need to go into the science of it. I didn't need to go into the minutia of it. It's sort of like he's using a cane, he's limping, he's got arthritis, something like arthritis.
Right.
That's really all I ever told people.
Can we talk about your brother a little bit?
My brother was a really good songwriter and guitar player. He was in the folk scene in New York, and he developed Parkinson's. He started showing symptoms at about 48. He made it to just past his 60th birthday, but he was in a nursing home for a long time. He was, I think, at about 53, because he started hallucinating and there were all sorts of problems. I don't even know all the details, but I know the cops had to be called a number of times because he thought people were breaking in the house or would get in arguments with neighbors and things because he started hallucinating. It was not good. And the worst part was watching him lose his ability to really speak. The last couple years of his life, he couldn't speak very much. This is a guy who was a really good songwriter. He was much better with, I always talk about the fact that his vocabulary was so much better than mine. He could pull a word out of the air to describe any situation. He was a really good writer. And then watching him lose that ability was heartbreaking.
How did it affect you? Did it?
A number of ways. It's funny because we were never that close, even though we both had Gaucher's disease and we had our spleens removed the same day at Mount Sinai Hospital. But we were never that close and I never knew why. I think part of it was that I was very open about the fact that I had this illness and he wasn't. I think he was afraid I would blow his cover in one way or another by talking about it. But I landed up having to become his caregiver, and I would go back to New York every 2 months, check on him, because, you know, if you're in a nursing home, if you don't have an advocate, your stuff disappears. Things don't happen for you. You don't get the right treatment. So I would go back every 2 months to New York for a couple of weeks. It was really hard because I just didn't know what was going on with him. I think he did not like the fact that I was the one left standing. My mom and my brothers had both died. My dad had died 30 years before. So I think he found it uncomfortable, but we couldn't even talk about it. The last couple of years was very rough, I think, for both of us, but especially him, to be that young and have to be in a nursing home.
And you mentioned the toll that these diseases that we have, these chronic conditions we have, take on family and friends and relationships. You mentioned also you didn't expect to live past 30. You must deal with relationships in a very different way now.
Yeah, it's like it gets back to that clock ticking thing. You know, when I was a kid, the clock was ticking till I turned 30, and then I made it to the new medicine, and now it's ticking again as I'm getting older. But yeah, I mean, so the woman I'm dating now, I dated her when I was younger, and I didn't take it very seriously back then. I didn't take anything very seriously back then. I always, when I'm giving lectures, I always talk about my retirement plan when I was young was to die. I'd never saved any money. I didn't buy a house. I didn't have a 401k. And then once there was this new medicine, all of a sudden I was like, wow, I'm really playing catch up here. I need to think about a retirement and what's going to happen when I get old. Because, you know, if you don't think you're going to get old, it frees you to do a lot of things like not saving money that other people take for granted that they have to do.
Can we step back now to when you went to the medical school and started teaching there?
So after I started doing the SCAR project, I had all these stories and the stories. So the process with the SCAR project is somebody comes in, I talk to them for about a half hour or longer about their scar, how they got it, what it means to them. Then we do a print. I roll ink on them and I pull a print and then I paint back into it. But during that period where they're telling their stories, I heard about the good things that happened in their medical care and the bad things that happened in their medical care. So I called up initially USC and UCLA and I said, I have this idea of a way to bring patient art into the medical school. And the idea was not to bring my art in, but it was to bring in art by other patients that were doing work, because through my work, I kept meeting these other patients that did work. So I was at UCLA for a little bit, but then USC called me up one day and said, we have a real gallery for you and we'll give you an actual job at the medical school running this gallery. So what I do now is I curate 5 shows a year by patient artists. Each one is tied to the core curriculum and to the body systems, the biosystems that are being studied by first and second year students. So for a neurology section, I would bring in an artist with Parkinson's, which I have done, or someone with MS. But they have to be doing work about the illness. It's not like I want a picture of their cat. I want a picture that represents their lived experience. Because there was one hospital I used to be in when I was a kid, which was a teaching hospital. And I had memories of 12 interns coming in, tapping my stomach because I had a very large spleen before it was removed, and talking about my illness like I was a lab rat, and then all walking out and never saying anything to me like, how are you? And I decided that memory just stuck with me. So I decided a long time ago, if there was ever anything I could do to change that dynamic, I would do it. So my idea, I approached the medical school. I said, I want to bring in these artists and they're going to talk about how their illnesses tell their life story with their illness. I'm sorry, how their paintings, sculptures are going to tell their life story, their patient narrative. Because there's just so many things that you can look at a painting and get an emotional feel for, that looking at a chart and going, okay, his enzyme levels are low and his hemoglobin is high and blah, 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 blah. That's not really going to tell you what the patients are going through. But it, you know, there's that saying, a picture's worth 1,000 words. And a lot of patients do some amazing work that's worth more than 1,000 words. So I bring them in. And what we do now is I interview the patient, but I also have a medical specialist from that field on screen at the same time, or on the stage at the same time. And the doctor has to talk about the artwork and the patient artist has to talk about their medical care. And wow. Then they start having this cross conversation about the lived experience and things the doctors didn't know about them and their life. And the it's always an amazing conversation. And the doctors are pretty insightful about the artwork. But the whole idea is because I want the first and second year med students to look at these patients and think, okay, they're complete people. And they might have Parkinson's or they might have had a heart transplant, but look, they're making art out of it. There's a good that came out of it. There's an expression that came out of it. There's art that comes out of it. So that's why I'm at the med school. That's how I landed up there. And I've been at USC Keck for 6 years now.
Talk about a freaky Friday. I've often wished we could switch places. There's that great song called Switch where, you know, what if we could just switch for a day? That does employ that opportunity, right?
Yep.
To get into a person's space. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Big issue, what you just said, is that with Parkinson's, when you get diagnosed, not one person says, how are you? Talk about our mental wellness. What you did by connect, how can we take what you did to turn it into something we could do in Parkinson's, because we cannot get the doctors to even touch that.
Well, so I just had a Parkinson's guy on last year. This amazing artist. And the patient was talking about how he started feeling in his hand and he was losing movement. And I said to the doctor, okay, this patient comes to you and you realize he's got Parkinson's and you know what's ahead for him. What do you tell him? I always ask the doctor, what do you say to the patient to prepare them for this chronic illness that's coming? You know, and sometimes they have good answers and not. But I can see with some of these doctors, not the ones that I put up on stage because they're real experts. They're usually the heads of the departments. But I think a lot of doctors could be afraid of getting sued if they tell you the wrong thing or make it sound like it's going to be worse and you have mental trauma, or they don't tell you enough and not prepare you. I mean, this people are so litigious now. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard for some doctors to be completely honest.
Well, in our situation, there's muscle movement and then there's the mental wellness side. And how can you send a person out into the world? And we talk to so many people. I cannot tell you how many people say, or I read it on Facebook, why am I depressed? Why am I feeling this? Why am I sad? Why am I, you know, sitting on the couch? It's not a complete diagnosis without that information. So what you've done, I wish we could create what you've done into this world so we can have the doctors doing that, showing empathy.
Well, bring me to a Parkinson's convention and I'll do it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Put it together for you.
We really need to get you there. Along with the Prince of Darkness, Ozzy Osbourne. You all should come up on stage and then we'd get their attention maybe.
Yeah.
Ozzy up there, Ted? Come on, let's do it.
I'll bite the head off a chicken.
See, what I like about Ted's putting your artwork and having the doctor to get a conversation going. It's great. It's a great idea. I love that part of what you talked about.
And it really is interesting how, because a lot of times I thought, I'm going to get the doctors on stage with this big projection of a piece of artwork behind them and say, what do you think of it? And they wouldn't know what to say, but they are remarkably insightful. And the other things that I talk about with the doctors when I have them on stage is why they chose their profession. Why do they want to be a neurologist? Why do they? Because I totally believe that there are some doctors that are suited to be in the emergency room and live off adrenaline and see somebody one time and patch them up. And there's doctors that should work with you guys that are going to be with you for 20 or 30 years. And it's a completely different skill set as far as listening and action for them and adrenaline and focus. So I try to really push on the medical students to be sure they're picking the right specialty as they go through med school.
You want to talk about the Wounded Veteran Project you're working on now?
Yeah, so I'm at the moment, I am just starting a new project where, and it sort of came from these whole conversations I've been doing at the med school, where up till now I have done the veterans or anybody else getting a scar, and I've talked to them about their scar, but I'm going to do a short film where I'm interviewing veterans and their partners, because I also want to know what the partner thinks when they see the scar on their husband or wife. You know, these people, a lot of times they get married young, their partner goes to Iraq or whatever and almost died over there. And the scar is not only a reminder for that person, but it's a reminder to the wife or the kids or the husband of the veteran, what emotionally they went through. And I haven't explored that yet. So that's the next project that's coming. I'm going to actually shoot the first interview next week.
It's always exciting when you start a new project. It's kind of like birthing a baby.
Yeah, I hope. But yes.
Do you have a team that you work with, or do you have special people to you that kind of get your process, you bring along, or are you solo?
I've got some people that are helping me. My partner is going to produce this. She wants to do that. And I'm, you know, it's funny. I did a movie about 2 years ago by myself during COVID, and an artist out in the desert. It won some awards. A nice little short, but I want this one to look a little more professional. So I'm going to bring in a real editor rather than do it myself and things like that. But basically, it's going to be me just interviewing people.
And can you tell the listeners what the name of that film that you mentioned was?
King of Dino Land. Cool. It's on YouTube. They can watch it for free.
That'll do it for this episode, folks. Come back next time for more inspiring guests. Thanks for listening. Have a great night, everybody.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain.